Your support. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice.
Peace, this is Aton Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Good morning. Welcome to Community Watch and Comment, the Wednesday edition. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at 89.3 FM, WPFW, Pacifica Foundation, Washington, D.C., for 40-plus years, thanking you for your support and your interest in listening. This morning, our show is titled Pushing Back on Systemic Racism, and there'll be a particular focus under that theme, highlighted by our guest, Dr. Donald Earl Collins, who's an historian and freelance writer. He teaches and lectures in history at UMUC, University of Maryland University College, and American University. He's the author of Fear of, quote-unquote, Black America, Multiculturalism, and the African-American Experience. Dr. Collins, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, David. Good morning to you as well.
Well, without any delay, let's get right to it. I titled the show, given our conversation, Pushing Back on Racism, but there is a particular focus I think we both have in mind, and that is throughout American history and in the American ethos and in American society, it seems like one of the things that makes racism so intractable, so intransigent, so persistent is a notion that it is powered or energized, or that one of the main drivers is something we could call narcissism. And I wonder if you could explain that for us.
Sure. The research that I've been doing over the last 3 to 5 years has looked at the issue of how do we decouple the conversations that we normally have when we do have conversations about racism, certainly not national ones, but amongst ourselves. We talk about racism as being systemic or structural, institutional, interpersonal, even internalized racism in the form of colorism or self-hatred or loathing and so on. People talk about racism in terms of hatred or in terms of power, but not necessarily both. And what I'm trying to do is trying to understand the problem more than trying to actually come up with solutions, because nothing we've tried has really solved this problem, because racism in the United States is sort of a lattice work of different pieces. And so looking back at things like Du Bois's notion of the material and psychic wages of whiteness, which he talks about in his book, Black Reconstruction.
Again, let's just highlight that material and psychic wages of
whiteness.
Of
right?
whiteness.
Yeah, which is, you know, sort of the residue of practicing systemic racism. And with that, one of the things I've thought about is how, you know, we talk about our society as sort of being this society of individualism where individuals can pull themselves up by imaginary bootstraps and make it to the top, which is obviously not the case for most people. And just thinking about it in terms of what social psychologists and sociologists talk about as being an epidemic of narcissism in this country and sort of putting peanut butter and then chocolate, together and making a Reese's peanut butter cup. For me, to understand the history of racism in this country, you have to understand the benefits of it to particular folks. We're talking about white Americans, or talking about rich white folks, or even some people of affluence who are of color. There has to be a psychic wage as well. And that has to be something that benefits them but hurts other people. And what better way to define that by looking at it in terms of narcissism? So that's sort of where I'm coming at it.
So
from.
If you allow me a certain reiteration, here it goes. You talked about all the different manifestations of racism and how we engage it, how we combat it, how we struggle with it. And most of these manifestations, whether they're systemic, intrapersonal between two or more people, or structural, they all have the American conversation thus far has been primarily focused on the material manifestations of these things, whether they're between persons, whether a person encounters a system that in this case mistreats them, or whether it's an institution holding fast to a certain behavior, certain values, certain standards reflected in that behavior. Americans, for the most part, if I'm not getting it wrong, talk and contend over these material manifestations. The focus on narcissism, how self operates with these things, has a lot to do with what's our motivation, what's been the ethos that's been driven in our brain and our spirit that we can so reflexively, act these things out. Do I have it right for the most part?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, when you think about, you know, and you don't have to just look at the academic literature on this. Just pick up any article that talks about racial disparity.
Well, let's have at it. There's certain manifestations that are with us today. We have a present occupier of the White House who's clearly been identified by folks across political spectrums of thinking as having a foundation of race and racism as part of his operating procedure. I've encountered too many of these to the point of exhaustion in the last few weeks, people out of a claim of pride for themselves and for America, perpetrating violence and certainly harassment upon people of color. And the list will just go on and on as we talk during the hour. These things are not coming out of a vacuum. They have historical momentum, and they certainly represent sophisticated, say, zeitgeist, but the spirit of the age.
Sure. I mean, most people talk about this in terms of, well, and I typically call the person who's occupying the White House 45. I completely agree with Lawrence Fishburne about that. You have not to call him by name. I mean, he's sort of like Voldemort. But anyway, for those of you who know who Harry Potter is. But the fact is that he doesn't come out of nowhere. And the people who support him, his fans, don't come out of just anywhere. From crawling down on a rock. What he has essentially done from a historical standpoint is pick a scab that has been covered up with layers over the years, and he's picked it raw to the point where it's oozing and it's obvious. And that's really the difference of where we are now versus where we may have been, say, 10 or 20 years ago. We can see it is so obvious, the cravenness, the lack of empathy, the me first, to the point where it's well beyond selfishness, but it's always me first. I get two, you get one, I get three, you get one kind of thinking that comes with him and his fans.
So let's take this step by step. Reflecting the practice of your profession is that you teach And I'm sure you've encountered students fresh out of high school and all sorts of collegiate settings. And as a professor of color, I imagine here's what you get. Especially when you're charged as a teacher about American history before the 20th century, you're talking about race too much. I haven't been taught this. Slavery was a main driver for the Civil War. How could that be? I thought it was a matter of the states wanted to be sovereign and separate because as the government was becoming more centralized and more federal, it was imposing its will unfairly. And I've just started the list. I wonder if you can confirm that that's indeed what you've encountered.
Yeah, I would say that over the last, I've been teaching off and on since 91. I've been teaching American history since 92. And certainly between UMUC and other places, I've taught plenty of courses on U.S. history, world history, African-American history even, in which some of my students, it's usually one or two. There might be others who hold this view, but it's usually one or two who openly complain that I'm talking too much about race, or I'm talking too much about racism, or that I remember one evaluation I got a few years back where a student said, he has an unusual approach to history, as if my approach is like no one does this.
Yeah, it's
no
out
one,
of the norm.
Right? No one else talks about the central role of slavery in building America up, and building America's economy and making people rich and making America this powerful nation. Great for some, nightmare for others, but still a great nation overall. So,
quite not only by students, but it's done by adults with the charge of teaching. And it's done quite adroitly. It's almost like a perfected martial art in the sense that it's so reflective and so embedded that most of us in our day-to-day lives either don't question it or don't have the opportunity to question it.
Sure. I mean, the fact is, when most people approach American history as if it's mostly white, mostly male. Sometimes you throw in women here and there to talk about things like cult of domesticity or the women's movement. But generally speaking, it's a white male thing first. And so when you inject race or talk about race in various manifestations, you can talk about white ethnics and race, and some people would be uncomfortable with that. You can talk about Native Americans, and some people would be uncomfortable with that. So fact is, it's something that's been part of, it's completely embedded in the brick and mortar of every institution of American society. And why should academia and education in general be excluded from that?
So we're in the realm of the academy, but we're certainly referring to things that are broader than that. And I like there's an excerpting from one of your articles that just pops out as far as the phrase that kind of captures most of this. Stereotypical white intellectual and academic superiority align well with the American ethos of individualism and earned achievement. The American ethos, earned achievement, just illustrate that, broaden that for us so it's clear.
The general idea is that America is this great meritocracy, or just a place where with hard work and dedication, you can make it. Right? You can make it materially in terms of making money and having a job. You can make it educationally in terms of getting a high school diploma or a higher education. You can make it in terms of having a family and being all things to your kids and your spouse and have your dog. And, you know, basically, if you're heterosexual, white, and male, this is the ethos you've lived with your whole life. It's, in fact, the ethos that everyone lives with.
But this is a conjurer of our society then. So if you're either average, and I'm making a play on words here, as you'll see, or well-behaved, or exceptional, offering something to the rest of us, then no matter who you are, you will be accepted. You can live at peace in your community. Certainly your kids have every opportunity afforded them. Where we all claim a camaraderie that's simply not there in a day-to-day experience or looking at it historically. So I hope listeners take it that I was talking with a great deal of irony there. And this alignment that we're talking about, again, individualism, in the fact that we're all pursuing the American dream. And so in our struggle and striving, of course, we're never unfair to anybody else. You know,
right.
We're never, pardon the expression, but you might chuckle at this. We're never rigging the system for our interest. We're fair to and welcoming to everyone. I think people are getting the idea as I go on with all these extensions that are, people don't believe that they're firmly in place, but they indeed are. Otherwise, we wouldn't be caught in the various situations, both present and past, that we've been in historically, where people have really caught the raw end of oppression.
Right. This nation's a living, breathing contradiction. That's bottom line. And sometimes those contradictions hit you right in the face with the things going on at the U.S. border over the last 2 or 3 months, with the daily recordings of Black people just breathing and living their lives, having the police called on
at a coffee shop, at a park.
Right.
Yeah. There was a Latino woman who is clearly a U.S. citizen, not getting the police to help her when a drunken agent, white male, is questioning her citizenship, running up to her face, all because she wears a full-blown blouse or T-shirt that represents the Puerto Rican flag, which is indeed part of the United States.
Right. But would it matter if she weren't a citizen of the U.S., wearing a Puerto Rican flag or a U.S. flag? That person, she didn't look like she belonged here. Didn't mm-hmm. matter. To some extent, that's just the excuse to cover up the fact that this person wanted to impose his sense of who this country should be and who the people in this country ought to be made up of on that person. And that's where, you know, a lot of these contradictions lie. Sure, we're accepting as long as you're white, male, and heterosexual and have money, right? We're accepting as long as you adhere to and ascribe to the things that we say American society is all about without questioning the contradiction. So these are the kinds of things that we confront as people of color, as vulnerable communities, as marginalized groups every single day in our society.
Listeners, let me remind you, you're listening to Community Watch and Comment, the Wednesday edition. I'm your host, David Whetstone. The voice that you've heard is that of Dr. Donald Collins, historian and freelance writer, author of Fear of Black, quote unquote, America, Multiculturalism, and the African-American Experience. Our conversation is continuing regarding pushing back on systemic racism, a focus on racism and narcissism and how it operates in the United States. Dr. Collins, so we've set up the larger frame of things, and what might be some important historical touch points or mileposts that folks could keep in mind to further illustrate what we're getting at in this conversation? What are the painful reminders of what is normalized and what is not right in treating each other as fellow human beings?
There are any number of approaches you could take here, but in terms of just the everyday sorts of things, popular culture, anything that you turn on the internet or watch on television or hear on the radio, how segregated our music tends to be. And even within that segregation between, you know, pop music on the one hand, hip hop on the other, and then country music are three main categories at this point. And the fact that even with that segregation, there's still a lot of cultural appropriation going on, and how people appropriate phrases, dance moves, whatever they want from hip-hop world and incorporated in their own videos for country music and pop purposes. Taylor Swift comes to mind. Miley Cyrus comes to mind is just one example. The fact that there's so many places in popular culture and so many situations in which you can have a television show in New York and still every character on the show is white. New York City, a city that is predominantly Latino.
Yeah. Well,
black.
Over half of people of
right.
color.
Yeah. And yet the show is still about how white people were experiencing the city. Or if it happens to be a show about black folk, how they're experiencing the white gaze, how whites interpret the lives of black people. Orange is the New Black comes to mind when I think about shows like that. So we're constantly fed a steady stream of a country that purports to be about, you know, I love you, you love me, kind of like a Barney song. But at the same time, the coded, the not so hidden message is, it might be, you might have all this melting pot kind of stuff going on, but the reality is whites are always on top. So
could you say more about the inevitability of racism in American society, particularly how we gotten to this point and not realized it?
We've been at this point practically from Jamestown. From the moment Englishmen came to these shores in 1607 to settle at Jamestown and decided that they wanted to look for gold, to try to figure out a way to become rich and try to exploit the land, the Native Americans who were here, who started dying off practically as soon as they arrived. And then upon realizing that they couldn't enslave Native Americans without being in wars with them, eventually bringing black people
ashore. So, for instance, on that point, you have students and others that don't understand that the First Nations populations of this country were decimated almost at a rate up to 90% of their original standing before Europeans arrived.
Sure.
On the matter of enslaved Africans, you mentioned Jamestown. It's not unfair to say that within 2 to 3 decades, laws started manifesting themselves to control black bodies, but also who relates to who and how they relate to each other.
Sure. I'll just give one quick example. That is, it's not just black bodies, it's black women's bodies. The laws that were passed to codify slavery put the onus of slavery on black women, so that when black women would have their kids, those kids would automatically be enslaved. And so it created generational chattel slavery, not just you're selling yourself potentially into slavery or being kidnapped into slavery for your lifetime, but not only for your lifetime, but for your kids' lifetimes and their kids' lifetimes and so on. And so that's the permanence of that system that goes all the way back to the mid-17th century.
And you know something, can I set up a little bit of a question here? Chattel, it's so salient among historians, but you rarely hear that term in popular culture when we deal about enslavement and enslavement in its history in this country.
Okay, I'll just think about chattel. I think about chattel like cattle. When you think, just take the H out, think cattle. When you own an animal, for the most part, while people might be somewhat concerned about the suffering of animals, ultimately it's whatever the animal can provide you in terms of work, in terms of sustenance, in terms of clothing, that you care about far more than whether that animal has been treated fairly, right?
So the extension of this term,
right.
I think what I was alluding to in the question also is it generated tremendous revenue. It generated a tremendous momentum to a political culture organizing itself around, pardon the expression, this institution.
Sure. Without slavery, I mean, so much doesn't happen without slavery. Whether it's through tobacco or rice or indigo, or later on when the country is officially a nation state, cotton, that generates all kinds of revenue to buy more slaves, to for exporting those raw materials either to the northern United States to be turned into finished product, or overseas to places like the United Kingdom and France and other parts of Europe to be turned into finished product. And in the process, bankers are involved. In the process, merchants are involved.
Bankers, insurers.
Insurers are involved.
The southern part of our country is involved, but most certainly the northern part of the country benefits. Places like Rhode Island, Boston, New York, and
Philadelphia.
So on. In Philadelphia.
Yeah. Every city, every part of this nation's connected to
including our nation's capital, of course.
Of course. Where slave auctions were going on until 1863, if I remember correctly.
At the footsteps of the capital and right across the river in Virginia.
Yep. And so with that, you can't really escape it. You can't escape. You know, the fact that I think Princeton has recently revealed that, or Yale, one of the two schools, I think it's Yale, recently revealed that, oh yeah, we used to own slaves. Georgetown revealed it and started a program to give free tuition to the descendants
of enslaved people who were sold down into Louisiana to raise revenue for the school.
In 1838, that's when that happened. But Georgetown recognized that 2 years ago. Every institution, every major bank, everything you can possibly think of, shipping companies are connected to all of this. And so it's ingrained in every aspect of our society that people of African descent equal people who used to be slaves.
And all extensions thereof is a question of humanity, which we will get to. But allow me to remind our listeners that you are indeed listening to Community Watch and Comment, the Wednesday edition. I'm your host, David Whetstone. With us in the studio is Dr. Donald Collins. He's a historian and freelance writer. And we're talking about pushing back on systemic racism, a focus of the history of racism and narcissism in American culture. We'll be back shortly after the public service announcement you'll hear next.
The African American Civil War Museum kicks off its 20th anniversary commemoration on Wednesday, July 18th, 11 a.m., with an opening rally on the high ground. The public is invited to join the celebration at the memorial located at 10th and U Street Northwest. At 5 p.m., the museum presents a Jazz and Justice program featuring Georgetown University Professor of Performing Arts, Maurice Jackson, reading excerpts from his new book, DC Jazz, Stories of Jazz Music in Washington, to be broadcast live on WPFW. The museum is located at 1925 Vermont Avenue Northwest. A book signing follows, and the event is free and open to the public. Other activities include a prayer breakfast at a church on the historic Camp Barker site on R Street Northwest, a lecture series featuring Howard University professors, and a VIP awards program to be held at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. The closing ceremony happens on Saturday, July 21st, 10 a.m. until noon, and includes the inauguration of the George Washington Williams Heritage Trail. Colored troop reenactors will distribute free t-shirts to the first 200 participants to join the walk from Howard University, 2400 6th Street Northwest, to the African American Civil War Museum. For a complete schedule and additional information, call 202-667-2667 and visit our website at afroamcivilwar.org. See it and be inspired.
And welcome back to Community Watch and Comment, the Wednesday edition. I'm your host, David Whetstone. With us in the studio this morning is Dr. Donald Collins. Dr. Collins is a historian and freelance writer. We're talking about pushing back on systemic racism, but with a particular focus on what we call narcissism playing a role, a driver in the American manifestations of racism. You just heard a PSA about the African American Civil War Museum. It would be remiss of me not to acknowledge the passing of Dr. Harry Jones. Dr. Jones was a very crucial local historian here who lifted up a lot of neglected aspects of the Civil War and 19th century period in this country. Further, it's very much on my mind and on the mind of other programmers, the missing children who have been separated at the border as they and their families sought safety and asylum here in the United States. As you know, in this hour, if you've been listening within the last few months, the concern about our fellow neighbors, human beings, particularly children, is of grave and important concern to yours truly. I often mention the Black and Missing Foundation, who is tireless in their task and mission to increase awareness and exposure of missing persons of color, be they young or old, assist in finding such persons and returning them to their families and communities, and to educate communities, those of color and at large, regarding personal safety. If you want more information about the Black and Missing Foundation, go to BAMFI.org or call the toll-free number, which I'll say slowly, 877-972-2634. many things are going on around the world. You have 100-plus programmers here at WPFW who have been around due to your support over 40 years, such as Mwiza Mutale at 1 p.m. with Africa Now, focusing on today, Sylvia Winter, of Caribbean descent. She was an important playwright and scholar in her own right, and that's today at 1 on Africa Now, focus on Sylvia Winter. For other programming, whether you listen live or online, many of the programs at WPFW are available now on podcasts via our archives, iTunes, or Google Play Music. Once again, listeners, I thank you for tuning in this hour and across the grid here at WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station. This is the point, Doctor, where we welcome listener calls. I just want to acknowledge that we do have some calls waiting. But I want to remind listeners, if you haven't called within the last 4 weeks, and you can keep your questions, comments, and remarks between a minute to 2 minutes, we can welcome a great number of calls, extend our conversation, deepen our understanding, and hopefully you will feel empowered by that. The number that reaches here at the studio is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. Doctor, we've made our way through a thicket of things.
Yeah.
And
sure.
There's still much to be explained about narcissism and racism. I wonder if there was anything on your mind as far as a particular bridge into the second half of our hour.
Well, when I think about this from a historical standpoint and thinking about it in terms of everything that we're dealing with now, I mean, it's fairly obvious that 45 is a classic example of narcissism at its worst. I mean, like, you can't get any more narcissistic than this unless you're Genghis Khan, maybe, or somebody who's historically slaughtered millions of people, I suppose. But not to exaggerate it too much, but the fact is that when you think about the residue of what happens when you are in charge of large groups of people, their bodies, their labor, the profits that you make off of them, and create a culture and a society around that, one of the residues of that is having a society in which people think that they are better than who they are. That's typically what narcissists are. They are people who aren't like
we're extraordinary and we're exceptional, indeed.
Yes.
Okay.
And the only people who can recognize how great we are other people who are also like us.
Yes.
So
without further delay, because a few people have been very patient, we're going to go to Ali in D.C. You've been waiting for a long time. Please go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to call, and we're talking about historical context again. You know, I always like to go back to, you know, just the way that we look at it. You know, we're talking about of people that are not slaves. They are enslaved, but for a reason. You know, these groups of people were masons. These groups of people were planters. These groups of people were civilization builders, and they still are to this day. You know, when you talk about superiority over race, we're basically talking about the control of money. You know, it says I can buy the look of success. So if I print money, and I have access to give it to this person or that person, then I have to come and work for you just to get the money. So we're basically talking about the control of money. It's a lie. So because of the control of money, I can create the illusion that I'm better. So when we talk about white supremacy and black inferiority, we're basically talking about a lie. You know, it's a system of a lie. If I can get you to believe that I'm better because I control the money, then, you know, I can create an entire system on that historically. I can create financial institutions based on this lie, simply because I control the money.
Let's see if we can further investigate that. Dr. Collins, have at it, if you please.
Sure. Thanks for the call. Thanks for your comments. I would say that that's part of the story, but with American narcissism, racism, you have plenty of poor whites who also think the same thing. That so it's not just about money. It's about the ability to really say that on a psychological level, you know, that you are better than someone else. Maybe it's because you have access or you look like the people who have the money. Maybe it's because Because these people, the people who are brown skinned and who are black in this country, who have ancestors who used to be slaves, maybe because of whatever reason, but you're hanging your hat on something that says to you that you are better than these people and that you should have more power over these people, more power than these people possess in this society. So it's not just about the lie of we're better than these people because we have money. It's the lie that we believe that we're better than these people because we're better than these people in some psychological
and therefore
level.
That's why we have the money.
Right, exactly.
It's a sense of entrapment. You mentioned people, poor whites, for instance, as a group. Of course, there's the great debate about everybody being middle class in this country to begin with. But doesn't this represent a sort of an entrapment of sorts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but it's a deliberate trap. It's sort of like The Matrix, to use a movie example.
So they took either the red pill or the blue pill, I guess.
I think in this case, they took the blue pill.
Okay. And I'm sorry for that distraction. Were you going to say something further?
Yeah, I was just going to say that for them, this world was made for them. And so if there's any hatred with regard to racism coming from them, and there's plenty of it, it's this sense of entitlement that has not been reciprocated with them actually having material wealth. And so if blacks make it, if other people of color make it, they're resentful.
And that resentfulness really does manifest itself. It's very cyclical. So you get a level of operation where, for instance, the phrase America first, or you get the exchange of stereotypes about the other people. And people get caught up in that rather sublimely. It's almost very immediate. I know you practice history, but why is that so reflexive? Why is that so persistent in American history?
I think that when you think about how our society came about, all of the different pieces that it took to build this country, and this sort of notion that at the same time, we're going to gradually give first white males, eventually all whites, the ability to vote, the ability to own land, the ability to do things essentially that only rich white property males could do when this country was founded. Then there comes with this a sense of entitlement. And with that sense of entitlement comes, well, no one else should have this. It belongs to us. We look like these people. We are these people. Therefore, anybody else that comes to this country who does not look like this, look like us, or have access, shouldn't have access to all the things that we have access to.
And a few callers have been patiently waiting. I'm going to hang on this last point that you made, but I'm going to welcome the callers. RG, good morning. You're on the air. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I'd like the doctor to address the psychiatry and psychology of that syndrome that he described earlier as, I suppose, what might be considered elitism or exclusivism, which emanates from that.
Okay.
Give me a second to turn my radio down.
Yeah, and thank you, RG. I want to remind you and listeners that the two people sitting here doing this show, our discipline is history and not psychology, but I'll let Dr. Collins.
Well, yeah, but I wasn't quite finished with my point.
Okay.
And the other point being, the other point being that out of that psychology, you know, many times they will use technology, architecture, literature, language to substantiate that sense of superiority, be it albeit as fantastical as it might be. So my last point is that the concept of manifest destiny, as written into law, probably emanated from that same psychology. Could you go into that?
And RG, thank you. Those are really good questions. I like the fact that you're linking the sense of American advancement and progress. That's appreciated by yours truly. I'll let the doctor engage your question. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Mr. Westlow.
Thank you. That's a difficult question for me to answer. As David has said, I'm not a social psychologist. I don't have a degree in it. I've taken maybe two courses in psychology, but I do understand the general notion of what narcissism personality disorder is. And broadly speaking, we're talking about people not only who have lack of empathy, but they also have a you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, delusions of grandeur, right? And when you mentioned manifest destiny is just an outgrowth of a larger belief in American society that goes literally all the way back to Jamestown about the idea that America should basically be from the Atlantic to the Pacific, should be essentially an empire.
And also that this is pristine, uninhabited land, you know, that it's ours for the taking. It's just a vast expanse. Sometimes the language betrays something like waiting to be conquered, waiting to be settled,
right,
and so on and so forth.
Sure.
Patton in Virginia, you've been patiently waiting. Go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Okay, I would have to disagree with the whole thrust of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Because in American social theory, you find it on the left and on the right, there is always this missing piece, and that is poor white people. Now, I live in Virginia, and there are some very, very, very poor white people all over this state, all over this nation. Now, these poor white people are left out of the equation. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't say that some of these poor white people who live on 2 acres back in the woods, these people are desperately poor. These are the people that Trump speaks to. But in the national debate, there is never any talk about poor white people. It seems to be a taboo. You hear people say the poor and people of color, as if all African-American people are desperately poor and all white people are filled with money. And I think that is a basic flaw in your analysis.
And I would like to correct that for you. We did begin, and just a few moments before you called, we did do an acknowledgement of similar, but not quite the same as what you're getting at. And we We talked about how it disadvantages everyone in the society. And your question and your remarks do provoke further examination of that, if you allow us that. But I would say that it's not an either or. The reality of oppressions of people usually is no discriminator against persons, and it swallows everyone. And we need to attend to fundamental realities of what people have experienced.
Okay,
sit here as an African American male, knowing full well that in my educational process and the process of many other kids, we don't even have these conversations in any substantive form in the classroom.
Sir, may I speak?
Mm-hmm, surely.
This is for your callers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think you're just over-intellectualizing a basic fact, and that basic fact is that in the American culture, it is a taboo. It is a strong taboo, is that you do not talk about poor white people. You might mention them in passing.
Mm-hmm.
You might refer to them occasionally, but they can never become a major factor. Now, most of the welfare payments go to poor white people. We know mm-hmm. that.
That's right.
The cuts in Medicare affect poor white people, but that line of thought is never done. Now, I would like to say this in closing, that when my slave ancestors walked along these dusty roads throughout the South at the end of the Civil War with almost no education, no legal support, enemies at every turn, they did not adopt a philosophy of despair, a philosophy of hopelessness. You know, they did not do that. They did not, what are we going to do? Yes, they knew they had enemies, like Marcus Garvey did say. Part of your education should be to realize you have enemies. And you cannot use your enemy's ideology to fight your enemies.
Okay. So if you think you've developed the point, I'd like Dr. Collins to engage it, because I think you're making some points that should be addressed. So thank you, Patton. In all sincerity, I thank you for your call. Doctor, go ahead.
Thanks for your call as well. I just want to say that the last year and a half, 2 years, I think, I'm just talking about just the media in general, and I'll move on to talk specifically about historians real quick. That's all we've talked about, practically, have been poor whites in rural America, poor whites in small towns across the country who might have voted for Trump or have racial animosity or are feeling economically oppressed and so on and so forth. They only seem to come up typically during election years, but we've expanded it because somehow we can't believe that 45's in office. So we have to try to explain it by talking about poor whites.
And by the way, that language is blame them,
right?
Where the demographics of voting has not proven that. It's people who earn six figures who seem to be more ardent supporters. Sorry, I had to get that point of commentary.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But be that as it may, I mean, the caller's right. We don't spend a lot of time talking about poor whites, which is why when I talk about the whole issue of racism, narcissism, you have to account for poor whites and their support of policies that hurt them economically. There's no way to explain that in terms of their material benefit without understanding the psychological to some extent. To understand that they see themselves more like someone like 45 who's in office, or more like Warren Buffett, or more like Michael Bloomberg than they do me
you
or you.
You too can become a millionaire.
Exactly.
And that's a privilege aspiration. I don't mean to be mocking when I say that. Doctor, I'm sorry. We do have plenty of calls. Let's do our best to get a few more people.
Okay.
Hector, good morning. Hector in Maryland, you've been waiting. Good morning. Your question or comment?
Yes, it was a comment pertaining to the man who had called and talked about the poor whites in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And go right ahead,
okay.
Please.
So here's my thing, right? Here's my catch on this thing. And that for a black person to even care about poor white people, is anyone talking about the poor Native American Indians?
They've been erased. Yeah. Unfortunately, politically, they've been erased. Yeah.
Right. And here's the thing. When black people start to talk about poor white this and so on, some type of sentiment, black people tend to forget that it was the same poor white trash who would, in these days of slavery, would whip them to death. So my point is, black people, just like Hispanics, just like Native American Indians, need to stop being butt kissers to these people and need to now focus all that energy in helping the people that have been on the bottom for so long. The reality is, poor white trash, even though they might be poor, have more power than black people in this country. That's the reality.
And Hector, if that's the thrust of your point, I'd like to take some other calls, and we'll be mindful of what you've said, okay?
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Marie in D.C., you've been patiently waiting. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Good morning. I want to say that I completely agree with you and with your guest. I don't completely agree with the last caller.
There's a hierarchy of pain that, my philosophy is, if you're present with your pain and suffering, let's attend to it. Let's increase the opportunity to deal with everybody's pain. I'm sorry, Marie, go ahead.
Oh, yes, and I agree completely with that. But what I wanted to also add is that we need to be more specific about the natives of the United States. He referred about the poor whites. Yes, they are in a situation, but even they have more assets as a collective, socially and financially, than the natives of America, the native blacks of America, collectively. And not enough is being talked about that.
Okay, and thank you, Marie. Again, we'll keep some of your comments in mind as we were proceeding with our conversation. And again, I want to honor another caller here. I believe it's David Allen in D.C. Can you turn down your radio and go ahead with your comment? We're running out of time. Are you there, sir? Okay. Dr. Collins, this gives you an opportunity to talk about this notion of how people identify or don't identify racially. There's a notion of being the object of a stereotype or being, and you can explain this, an anti-stereotype.
Sure. social psychologists like Claude Steele have talked about this idea of disidentification hypothesis and stereotype threat. And all that really means, getting through all the psychological verbiage, is that there are situations that people can find themselves in, depending on their race, gender, age, sex, whatever, in which they feel like they're the odd person out. Right. Whether it's in the form of education, they're the person who's doing, they're the exception, they're doing really well compared to their cohort in their, you know, among African American males, or they're not doing so well in terms of compared to other whites. And I've written about this in a couple of places. And so they'll latch on to either their racial superiority as a way to make themselves feel better, or to latch on to the fact that they might be a great athlete or a great orator in order to make themselves feel better in an academic situation which they're not doing well.
So they're choosing to identify or disidentify with things.
Right, as a result. And so, you know, I mean, narcissism can play a role in this, but it doesn't always play a role in this. It can specifically, if you are white, play a bigger role, because of the fact that you're expecting to do well in so many situations.
So I know we're winding up, but I need to ask you at least one more important question. Black historians, black writers, even the most severe critics of the wrongs that go on in our society, often end their work, their presentation in a moment, with some hopeful optimism.
Sure.
Have some of us gotten it all wrong?
I wrote an article that asked this exact question for Al Jazeera last summer. And, the fact is, I use examples from Ibram Kendi's book, Stamped from the Beginning, and Carol Anderson's book, White Rage, is just two of many examples where they end their book, a book that spends 300, 400, 500 pages breaking down all these issues and saying, we're going to make it somehow. And for me, that's not sufficient. And I also don't think it's even necessary, because maybe we will, maybe we won't, as a people, as a society, but we're not going to, but ending optimistically, I think there's a difference between having hope and faith.
Yeah, and I wasn't
optimism.
Asking you to give us happy resolution. Yeah. I just want to make that clear. And yeah. You still have a minute if you wanted to complete that thought.
Yeah, I don't think it's just, it's about, you want to work towards something, hopefully, break through a ceiling, break through the lattice work, have some success. But I don't think we should be in the, working toward trying to figure out where we're going to be and trying to be predictors of where we're going to be at 100 years from now. I think that's sort of more the role of a prognosticator or someone with ESP, maybe.
Yes. So, Dr. Donald Collins has been with us. We've been talking about racism and narcissism in American society. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us this morning. I do believe this has been quite a constructive and encouraging conversation nonetheless.
Thank you for having me.
That will about do it. My thanks to the News and Public Affairs Departments of WPFW, our Administrator Jamila Mahdi, our engineer Mike Nasella. And as always, I encourage you to make it not only a great day for you, yourself, but for others. Coming up next is the news, and have a great day. Take care. Leaves us to our tears.
more lawmakers. In the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. We shall not stand down. We'll not be your clown. We the people. We the people. We the people. All the flame burning bright. Ooh, the perilous
Good afternoon. These are the headlines. I'm Rob Sims. The D.C. Council could be poised to overturn Initiative 77, a contentious measure approved by voters in the June primary election, which would mandate employers to pay the standard minimum wage to employees who rely on tips to supplement their pay. The measure passed on a 55-45 margin, though critics say it happened in a primary election where turnout was low. But Council Chairman Phil Mendelson says what's even more striking to him is from where the opposition to the measure is coming. I have rarely seen an issue where the people purportedly benefiting from this have been as unified in their opposition, saying that this will not benefit them. Mendelson said that to NBC Washington. Mendelson also told the Washington Post that he won his primary race by an even bigger margin, but supporters of Initiative 77 aren't going away quietly. Proponents gathered at a D.C. Council meeting July 10th in anticipation that something might happen. Restaurant Opportunity Centers United Diana Ramirez says that they're disrespecting the democratic process. They're disrespecting the voters who overwhelmingly voted for this initiative. The Amplified Noise Bill proposed by three D.C. Council members was withdrawn during a meeting on yesterday by the council's chair. The Amplified Noise Amendment Act was proposed in the hopes to clarify noise levels and lower fines for street performers, but the bill drew criticism from performers and residents who launched the hashtag SoundproofDC. Under the bill, violators would first receive a verbal warning from a D.C. police officer or other law enforcement officer. If they continued after receiving that warning, they could be punished by a fine of up to $300, get up to 10 days imprisonment, or both. At the meeting, D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson defended the legislation, saying that there was a fundamental misunderstanding of the proposal. He said that the bill would not prohibit amplified noise, but only limit the levels of amplification. Mendelson said that if the music was so loud that it interfered with normal conversation 100 feet away from its origin, only then would performers feel the repercussions. Though the legislation was withdrawn, the original bill is expected to return for council consideration in the fall. Baltimore has launched a program to attract qualified young people for careers in the city's police force. Mayor Catherine Pugh says that the Cadet Apprentice Program will help train the next generation of police officers. In a statement made this morning, Pugh described it as part of a reform effort to ensure constitutional community-based policing. A federal consent decree mandating sweeping police reforms in Baltimore is gradually ramping up. It was authorized in January 2017 after the Justice Department detailed longstanding patterns of racial profiling and unconstitutional policing. There are 11 cadets currently in the program being approved for state accreditation. Cadets can start at age 18 and continue until they're eligible to enter the police academy at 20 and a half years old. Virginia Commonwealth University has renewed its contract with former Governor Doug Wilder despite his ongoing lawsuit against school officials. The Richmond Times-Dispatch recently renewed by the university, but the former governor makes $150,000 a year as a part-time professor. Wilder suing VCU and top school officials after he says his personal assistant was harassed and mistreated by the school's